From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an updated report of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, a lot going on as usual. Let's start with Venezuela, where things have continued to stay pretty hot.
Yeah, the big news in Venezuela was the release into what they call casa por cárcel, which is domestic custody. I think he served 3 years of a 12-year sentence for his role in causing the violence and death back in 2014 of over 40 people, for which he was condemned to 12 years.
Describe his name and describe who he is, of course, for those who don't know.
Yeah, and Leopoldo Lopez is one of the two most well-known opposition leaders in Venezuela, along with Henry Capriles, and there are other leaders like Maria Corina Machado and Jose Ramos Alup and people like that. But the Lopez and Capriles are regarded as the most belligerent of the opposition leaders. And Capriles somehow managed to avoid getting put on trial because he was also very involved in the violence of 2014. Right. But Leopoldo Lopez, all of these opposition leaders are people with a long track record of support for violence and anti-constitutional attempts to overthrow the legitimate government of Venezuela.
Yeah, they keep calling for a military coup, for example.
They took part in the 2002 coup,
right.
which Hugo Chavez was almost murdered. Right. Which lasted three days, and ever since then, they've taken part in every major activity to try and overthrow the government by unconstitutional means. And they're at it again now, and in what looks as though it's the most serious attempt since the 2002 coup to overthrow Venezuela's legitimate government. So that's who Leopoldo Lopez is.
Right.
And he's for the right wing in Latin America, he's regarded as a charismatic figure. But he's essentially a fascist, and his ideology is, however he dresses it up, what his actual policies and what his actual behaviour amount to, are a clear expression of his fascist beliefs. I know that the idea that corporate power should work with government in order to promote national development, and that's it. That's his ideological framework.
Mm-hmm.
The needs of the human person should be subordinate to the needs of corporations and the state. That's his ideology.
Yep, and that is fascist ideology.
So, in support of that ideology, he's engaged in extreme political violence. And as I said earlier, he was convicted of responsibility for the deaths of over 40 people, or a large number of those 40 people who died in the protests in 2014. So now his arrest for the international right wing was regarded as political, and the international right wing from the US government across to the Spanish government of Rajoy there in Spain, the Spanish prime minister, and all their sympathizers, they regard Leopoldo Lopez as a political prisoner.
Uh-huh.
And so they've been putting huge pressure on the Venezuelan government to outright release Lopez. And what the Venezuelan authorities have done, as I understand it, this is a decision by the the prosecuting authorities or the judicial authorities to release Lopez from prison, but to maintain his maintain him in custody, but in his house. So let's see how that pans out. And so, and that's it's regarded progressive commentators in the region regarding that as a positive step by the Venezuelan government. Others who don't agree with that, progressive commentators think that it's mistakenly giving the right wing the sense that the government is somehow weak. But in fact, the people that reading treats Venezuela as if it is in fact some kind of dictatorship where the government, whoever's in the executive branch, just do what they want, and that's not the case. And this this release of Lopez into domestic custody is an example of the way Venezuelans in institutional integrity is actually working.
Right, exactly. It shows, I mean, essentially the processes are operating normally despite all of the discord being, you know.
Yeah, and so the context in which that move has taken place is one in which the government is preparing for its constituent assembly, which involves the election of well over 500 representatives from every strata of Venezuelan society, in every part of Venezuelan society, to a constituent assembly to, as Nicolas Maduro puts it, change whatever needs to be changed in order to defend the Bolivarian revolutionary process.
Right.
And so the role of what the authorities are trying to do is to mobilize support for the constituent assembly and ensure that conditions prevail that will enable it to take place peacefully and in security.
And with legitimacy, in other words, that the people are well represented and that the outcome is actually constructive.
Yeah, and so what the opposition's objective is to sabotage that.
Of course.
But the problem that they have is that they do not have a majority support among the general population,
right.
And that's one of the reasons for the calling of the constituent assembly in the first place by the government is precisely to demonstrate that the opposition do not have majority support nationally, which is what they claim in their propaganda and which corporate media repeat endlessly as if. If you read media reports, the impression that you get is that there's an overwhelming majority of support for the Venezuelan opposition, but that's not true. They have something like, and core support, they probably have around 25%, maybe right. As much as 30. But the government actually has more support than that without having majority support. The government itself doesn't have majority support in terms of its core supporters. But at the moment, in this political configuration right now, at this historic moment, most people support the government. There's an independent opinion polling company called Hinterlaces, and I think we mentioned this last week,
yes,
that found that 58% of people in Venezuela support Nicolas Maduro as the person to see Venezuela through this current crisis, and only 36% support the Venezuelan opposition. Now, those figures include floating voters, the don't knows, because right. The core support of the government is probably something between, I don't know, around 35 to 40, perhaps a little more than 40% of the
right.
population, which is slightly more than the opposition have.
Right,
the battle, as always in Venezuela's electoral process, is who can mobilize the support of the people who are not politically committed.
Right.
Right. So,
and there, you have like there's a very strong class dimension to this support as well. racial, given the history of of the country and of the hemisphere, which in other words, those who tend to be working class or poor support the government. Those who tend to be middle class or wealthy tend to support the opposition. The core issues that they're fighting over essentially is. Are the economic issues. The opposition's complaint is that essentially the lazy poor have the government buying their votes by taking stuff from the hardworking middle class and giving it to them. The same story we hear in the United States for forever. And as in the United States and elsewhere, the further down the economic ladder you go, the more melanin you tend to carry in your skin, and that's so that those two overlays are part of the, the groupings on either side.
Yeah, very much so, Don. And that's why the government has majority support. And even now, over, I think it's 52% of people in the latest Hinterlaces poll that came after the one I mentioned earlier. They did another poll to try and measure levels of support for the process of the Constituent Assembly, and they found that 52 or 53% of the population support the Constituent Assembly. So that's a massive achievement for the government, because when you mention that the Venezuelan middle class are resentful of their current situation. And that's true, and they have legitimate reasons to be resentful, but those reasons have been created by the 2 or 3 years or more of economic sabotage by the Venezuelan opposition and the Venezuelan business classes, who are determined to get their political representatives back into power. And they see they have an opportunity, and they're trying to take it. But all the signs are that they're going to lose. Now, one of the things that the Venezuelan opposition are doing to try and sabotage the Constituent Assembly is they've called the Constituent Assembly, the votes for the Constituent Assembly to vote for the candidates who will compose it, happens on July the 30th. Now, the opposition have called a plebiscite, what they're calling a plebiscite, on July the 16th, on the referendum. And the obvious result of that will be that they'll get their people out to vote. They might get as many as 25 to 30% of the Venezuelan population to vote in their phony plebiscite. And then on the basis of that, they'll say, oh, well, the Venezuelan people reject the Constituent Assembly. But I'd argue that probably isn't mostly for internal consumption. That is for international consumption.
It's for the Americas section of the New York Times, basically.
Yeah, and that because the Venezuelan opposition know that domestically they have no chance of mobilizing majority support for their current positions, because over one of those Hinterlaces polls demonstrated that 85% of people in Venezuela, 85%, reject the street violence of the Venezuelan opposition. So they have a huge problem domestically of credibility, of being able to mobilize support and so on. They can readily mobilize their gangs. They just bus 400 or 500 people into a vulnerable small town, hold that small town hostage, project the images at an international level, and that makes it look like the whole of Venezuela is in chaos.
It's like ISIS. It's what they did. What ISIS did, only instead of guns and mortars and stuff, they go in with baseball bats and whatever it is, the chains that they use.
And they shoot people, and they loot stores and all that stuff. Yeah. Yep. So that's that is the fundamental problem of the Venezuelan opposition, and they've been. Working really hard and very decidedly, in a very determined way, to try and provoke an external intervention by the U.S. Southern Command, or some combination of the U.S. and its allies.
Yeah, OAS cloak.
You know, and they're very open about that. There was a forum in Miami a few days ago in which one of the leading politicians in the opposition membership of the National Assembly has explicitly said that they're determined to provoke more violence because they hope that that will instigate a foreign intervention.
Right.
He said that in as many words.
Yep. And you know what's interesting? I mean, contemporaneous with the poll that you referenced that shows 85% of Venezuelan people oppose the strategy of the opposition, the violence. At the same time that's happening, they're slamming helicopters against the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court ruled that they could have the referendum. And so, they don't really care at all. Like, their behavior is not baseline to the domestic political situation at all. I mean, that couldn't be more obvious.
Yeah, and the opposition do have, they have some cards to play. I mean, their position is getting more and more desperate, and that is reflected in the increasing desperation of their political violence. And one of the cards that they have to play in their favor is that they've managed to sway the attorney general, Venezuela's attorney general, a woman called Luisa Ortega. Now, Luisa Ortega is associated as I think I got this right. She's associated with a kind of social democrat style current within the a kind of fake left current within the government's overall political movement. I think they call themselves a Maria Socialista or something like that. But her husband is a leading ideologue of that political current. Mm-hmm. And they, for a couple of years now, they've been kind of vacillating between maintaining solid support for the government and trying to carve out some independent political position so they can still project themselves as left-wing and progressive, but oppose the government. And so she is a figurehead that the right-wing opposition are delighted to see her take positions critical of President Maduro and his government. But she now has taken an institutional step that has set her beyond the pale. She's now kind of self-excluding herself because she's refused to accept the authority of the Supreme Court to appoint a vice attorney general, a deputy attorney general, to whom she objects. And that's another example of the way the Venezuelan opposition is, their policies are essentially self-defeating and self-excluding, because it's likely that Luis Ortega herself will face some kind of institutional proceedings that will strip her of her authority as the Attorney General, because one of the criticisms that the government has made of her is that she has been extremely lax in prosecuting people from the Venezuelan opposition who are clearly involved in political violence, including killings.
Yeah.
So if Venezuela's attorney general isn't going to be apt to protect the general population, because most of the people that have been killed have not been either Chavistas or political members of the political opposition. They've been people that just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And if Luis Ortega is going to refuse to prosecute in order to protect ordinary people in Venezuela from the effects of the right-wing political violence, then she's probably signed her own kind of resignation, or I don't know how you'd put it.
But a death warrant for her career, for her ambitions.
She's handed the authorities a perfect reason, a legitimate reason, to move for her to act to remove her.
Well, that's her job. Her job is supposed to be to protect the public safety by seeing that the laws are enforced. That's her job.
Yeah, right. And it's as if the Attorney General in the United States had decided, without saying so in as many words, that they're not going to prosecute people responsible for very serious offenses against the state because politically it isn't convenient for them.
Not for nothing. Let's say I organize an anti-war protest, that draws 10,000 people in New York City. One of the people there steps outside of the lines that are set up by the police and falls down, and that causes two cops to step out of their positions two blocks away, and somebody gets in a car accident and dies. Here in the United States, if they didn't like politically what was going on with this particular anti-war rally, they would charge me with homicide as the organizer of this thing where the illegal activity resulted in death.
Right.
So, here we're talking about people who are on the streets, and screaming and going on television and in the media saying overthrow the government, and people are in the streets.
Yeah. They were armed.
Yep.
You know? So these are people that carry kind of homemade weapons and homemade bombs.
Yep.
Yes. And imagine that in the States. I mean, the double standards, as usual. I mean, there's nothing even. It's hardly even worth commenting on because we all know the double standards that apply in the international media. And if the Venezuelan opposition had tried that in a country run in a similar way to the United States, they'd have been shot dead within seconds.
Really, really. So that's what we have all that going. And I'm wondering too. Lopez had those 3 years in jail. It's a good time to write. I wonder if he was putting the finishing touches on Mi Lucha.
Right. Well, and let's see how that pans out. It may work out positively for the government, or it may work out positively for the Venezuelan opposition. There's so much in the balance in Venezuela right now. And the crucial thing is what will happen. And we know what's going to happen with the plebiscite on the 16th. The crucial thing is, what will there be a big enough turnout on July the 30th for the government to credibly claim legitimacy for its constituent assembly process?
Right. That's right.
And that's the good thing. So then, and over the border there in Colombia, and the peace process is advancing, and it looks as though the United Nations is going to go ahead and send in a second peace mission. The first peace mission that the United Nations had there was working with the government and the FARC guerrillas, supervising the disarmament process. And they did that quite successfully, and it looks as though they did a reasonably impartial job, a successful job. Certainly the FARC guerrillas seem to be satisfied with the behavior of the UN. That was the first mission. This second mission that was authorized, I think it was yesterday or on Saturday, it was authorized by the head of the Security Council, the president of the Security Council at the moment. It rotates his China. So the Chinese president of the Security Council authorized the second UN observer mission to Colombia, and the role of that mission is absolutely key, because essentially the first mission was the emphasis was on the FARC to comply with disarmament, but with this second mission the emphasis is going to be on the government. It's going to be on the Colombian government to meet the terms of the peace agreement, which they haven't done so far. And one of the terms of the peace agreement is the release of FARC prisoners who the FARC insist are political prisoners. And under the terms of the peace agreement, any FARC member imprisoned is entitled to an amnesty, and they should be released now. But the government's dragging its feet on that, or a better way to put it is the Colombian authorities are dragging their feet on that. And this has led to the FARC prisoners engaging in a hunger strike that's in its 13th day now. That hunger strike is supported by Comandante Jesus Santrich, one of the most important leaders of the FARC high command. And so that's a very big issue, and the importance of the second UN observer mission will be to ensure that the government does, in fact, and the Colombian authorities in general do, in fact, meet their obligations under the peace agreement signed in Havana a few months ago.
Yeah.
So, and that's that. There are problems with the peace process, but they don't look to be insurmountable as long as there's some kind of goodwill on the part of the government. And that's in Colombia, that's the key question.
Yeah.
Will the Colombian government meet its obligations, or will it succumb to pressure from the extreme right wing not to do so? And another key issue associated with that is, will the government crack down on illegal paramilitary activity by right-wing elements associated with the former president Álvaro Uribe, or what is going to happen with the paramilitaries? And that's obviously it's a process.
You know, you mentioned the UN Security Council. Well, you mentioned the UN people on the ground, and the UN Security Council. This month, China chairs the council, and the importance of that is that the chair sets the agenda for the Security Council, essentially for the month. This month, it's China, so perhaps the interests of FARC and fairness or whatever will be pursued, and the role of the UN people on the ground and that are working on Colombia, that'll be driven by China's insistence that the process be fair and even-handed and monitored. Next month, it's Egypt. After that, it's Ethiopia in September, then France in October, Italy in November, and Japan in December. So, no matter if China doesn't get a lot of this done this month, and I don't know how Egypt and Ethiopia will play out at the Security Council in terms of pursuing the fair process, but, you've got a lot of moving parts, and international players are certainly important.
Yeah, and as you say, a lot of moving parts. And so, time will tell how sincere the Colombian authorities are, and what their margin of political maneuver is within Colombia's domestic political scene.
Yeah.
And then another. Maybe we should have a quick look at Brazil if we've got time.
Very quick. We've got about a minute.
Yeah. So, in Brazil, a very important development. The O Globo Media Corporation, which is kind of a virtual monopoly of media news coverage in Brazil, admitted that it reported falsely that Lula da Silva had foreign bank accounts which were used to receive bribes.
Wow.
They admitted that was a lie.
Wow.
And that's a very important development in terms, because why is it important? Because Lula and his successor Dilma have been subjected to a kind of media judicial
lynching
trial. Yeah. Lynching.
Yeah.
And so for Globo to be forced to admit that it lied is really, really important.
Yes, it is.
On the other hand, this week, the public prosecutor will be reporting to the Justice Commission of the lower house in the Brazilian Congress on allegations of corruption against allegations of corruption against Michel Temer, the usurper president currently in power in Brazil. And they have a final vote on this controversial labor legislation, which is like, if that goes through, there's likely to be a general strike in Brazil.
We'll have to cover all of that next week, and we look forward to doing it. And thank you very much, Tony, for your time, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.